Welcome to the Mind Money Spectrum podcast, where your hosts, Aaron Ogti and Trishul Patel, go beyond traditional finance questions to help you explore how to use your money to achieve the freedom you want in life.
In this episode, Aaron and Trishul discuss what you can do with your ISOs to prepare for an upcoming liquidity event. At this point, investment risks are still high, so what's the best way to capitalize from here? First, you must consider the timing of the exercise. Next, you need to evaluate if you will cash out or hold on for more upside. For most people, it is some combination of cashing out as soon as possible, exercising and selling in the most tax-efficient manner, and holding on to your options or shares for long-term gains. And now, on to our conversation.
Hi, my name is Aaron Ogti. I'm a financial advisor in the Bay Area, and I'm here with Trishul Patel, a wealth manager on the East Coast.
Hey, Aaron, great to be here today, and thanks everybody for listening.
Great to be here as well. So last week we talked about, kind of continued our conversation on what to do with ISOs in a private company, so a pre-IPO company. And we kind of first talked about, like, when you first start and your exercise price equals the fair market value. Next conversation was you've been there for a couple of years and the fair market value is greater than the exercise, so you start to have AMT concerns, but there's still far enough away that any money you put into these ISOs and by exercising the options is still kind of very likely to be lost. I don't say very likely, but still you need to be ready to lose all this money. The next stage is now there's a liquidity event on the horizon. Maybe this is a tender offer. So I'll explain kind of some of the mechanics there where you can sell some of your shares now. This could be a acquisition from another company, could be a direct listing, or could be an IPO. You may not know the exact timing. It may not be receive that information until you're pretty close. And I guess I think one factor here is I didn't mention earlier. I'm kind of assuming that the employees that I work with, and I do verify with this, but in the past conversations, is that there's no inside information, that we're not acting on any material non-public inside information. And so kind of the people who are privy to inside information would know the kind of IPO dates or what that schedule is be. So, but they also have kind of completely different planning concerns for insiders. So kind of most of what we're talking about is the employees who do not have access to inside information, therefore do not know when liquidity events are happening and kind of have to plan around that unknown investment risk. So this would be, again, tender offer, IPO, direct listing, or DPO, direct public offering, or an acquisition. But kind of the big theme now is you can start to plan on these options being worth something. We're no longer assuming that any money that you put into this stock, you have to be willing to lose. This is now, that possibility still exists. So there's still investment risk. It is higher than investing in a small public traded company. So a private company, like, it's still possible that the IPO doesn't happen. It's possible it gets delayed. It's possible that there's an acquisition, but the share class of stock that you own doesn't get paid out or doesn't get paid out the same as what you're thinking about. So there still is kind of a bigger investment risk, but you can start kind of putting more dollars at risk and planning on having some kind of payout. So the most common way to illustrate this is, let's say there's an IPO. It's still possible that once the IPO happens, you as an employee have a 6-month lockup and the stock price drops by a lot during that lockup. And it's kind of illustrated, like, it's not that the company didn't pay off, and like you still get something, but you can't necessarily depend on specific values. Like you'll probably get something, but you still don't know how much or how little. I guess does that make sense in terms of kind of how to frame the mentality of it's still a high investment risk, but it's not, but it's significantly less likely that it goes to zero.
Yeah, so let's see if I can frame the big concern here. So you have these ISOs, and the company's going to IPO soon. So, you know, all that hard work over the last couple of years and all that planning and since you started the job and making sure you get your ducks in a row, it's all coming to your head at this point. Mm-hmm. And now that the IPO is on the horizon, it seems like the big concern here is, okay, when do you exercise? And it seems like the trade-off is, the sooner you exercise, the sooner you can start the clock ticking on the 1 year period for being able to satisfy the requirements so that you can then be able to sell the shares and get long-term capital gains treatment. Is that the big concern here on why you may want to exercise sooner rather than later?
That's probably the most, I don't say sooner rather than later, but that's probably the closest that we're now starting to, I think you're close that yes, the sooner we exercise, the sooner we start the clock. That is a factor. But because of the lockup, which is common with IPOs, it's kind of a combination of like, ideally you're exercising 6 months before the IPO, but you don't know exactly when the IPO happens. So it's hard to know 6 months in advance. And so that's kind of the trade-off is that we're trying to find that balance of, yes, you want to get the clock started, but the ideal time to start may not have enough information. So we start to get pretty specific with timing. You start to get kind of specific with liquidity, and now you can actually do some of the kind of big picture tax planning. Like, okay, now it's if we exercise and sell, here's what our ordinary income will be. If we exercise and hold, here's what our AMT will be, but we'll get long-term capital gains and maybe an AMT credit. So it's like the numbers start to get bigger, but now we have a kind of, it's this like, this balance of timing and information that can kind of impact some of our decisions at this stage. So before we get to an IPO, one thing that I do want to talk about is sometimes you'll see a tender offer. This would be a company that's not public, but the company acknowledges that, hey, our employees have been around for a long time. They'd like to start exercising, but they don't have the liquidity. So a tender offer is a way to get some liquidity by selling some shares. And then the employees can each decide, okay, I'm going to use this money to exercise and pay the AMT bill. I'm going to just cash out and kind of invest it somewhere else. Like they get to decide what they do with it, but there sometimes are tender offers done in advance. And this is not a sign of the kind of the first balancing act between that mentality of cashing out or holding on to upside. So these are kind of the two things that tend to come in play in conversation with the clients. One is timing and liquidity. The other is cashing out versus upside. Okay. So the tender offer, let's say you now have some stock that was, your exercise price is $10 per share. The current fair market value is $20 per share, but there's a tender offer of $40 per share. This tends to coincide with fundraising rounds. This can be a way for late stage fundraising rounds to buy shares. They don't need to create more shares to dilute the shares. They can sell employee shares to the fundraisers. So that's one of the ways that they can get that the tender offers come into play. It can also be the company itself buying shares. So they might be trying to kind of undo past dilution or kind of increase concentration, or just reducing the fewer number of shares that will go public, which can help the stock price. So there's a couple of reasons why tender offers, why companies might offer them, but they can be seen as a benefit to employees. And so this would be an example of, okay, you could sell, and sometimes it'll be like 25% of vested options plus shares that you own. And if you participate, you're going to get the tender offer. And depending on personal situation, this tends to be a really difficult decision, because if there are people willing to buy your shares at $40, and let's say it's a private equity firm or a venture capitalist or even the company itself, because the IPOs might happen in the next year or two, but they think the shares will be worth more than those $40. They think that the IPO will happen, will be a bigger payout. Then why don't you hold on to those shares? And that tends to be the kind of big theme that clients come to me is, okay, I can get this cash out, but how does it affect my lifestyle if I hold on to it and it pays off bigger? And so this is a big theme of the conversation I have with at this stage, both with the tender offers, but even at the IPO, is I use kind of numbers examples, but like kind of half joking around, you don't get to a net worth of $10 million by diversifying and saving in your 401k. You'll get a few million dollars. You'll get enough to be comfortable and provide for your lifestyle and be financially independent at some point in the future. But you won't get to a net worth of $10 million. The people who get to a net worth of $10 million did so through concentration and getting lucky. They were at the right company. They held on to the stock, and the stock paid off big. And this is where kind of more personalities and lifestyle come into play. So this is another big part of conversations. And this is also when clients are having these liquidity events and they have to decide between participating and selling and cashing out or holding on, the life planning questions and going through exercises like Kinder's three questions, that tends to be more impactful than getting the taxes right. And so I'll keep kind of talking about these two themes throughout the rest of our conversation today. But given that construct, the cash out versus upside is one theme, and the timing and liquidity being the other theme, what are some of the things that questions that come to mind for you that you want to make sure we address today?
Well, in the context of the tender offers, I'm not sure how common this is, but I've heard of positions where the executives wanted to sell out because, you know, they hold large shares and they've likely been in there the largest. But sometimes there's agreements where if the executives cash out, then other employees get to also participate in selling some shares. I believe that's known as the tag along provisions.
Mm.
They get to tag along. So minority shareholders get to tag along when majority shareholders try to gain some liquidity in their large positions. And then I've also heard of the other side known as the drag along. So that's the notion where a majority shareholder wants to cash out and minority shareholders are kind of forced to, they're dragged along, you know, with that offer to liquidate some of their positions.
Yeah, so those are good points. When it comes to tender offers, also, like, there is some planning in terms of how it's going to be taxed. So kind of in my example, I said, if strike price is $10, fair market, current 4.9A is $20, but the $10 tender is $40. You start to get into, if it's a, it depends if it's an outside buyer or an internal buyer. So if it's the company or another company that has a enough of an ownership percentage in the company, then the difference between the fair market value and the tender offer is considered compensation income. Kind of like it's, if it's an internal buyer, the IRS kind of assumes they have enough information that they think the stock price will be greater so that it's, they're paying out something more likely. So in our example, the, if you exercised at 10, and let's say you had already exercised in the past, then, and you had satisfied 2 years from grant date, 1 year from exercise, your basis was $10. Going from 10 to 20 was long-term capital gains, but 20 to 40 was compensation income. So it's taxed as ordinary income. But if it's an external buyer and you satisfied all the rules for the ISOs because you exercised early, then it could be considered all capital gains. So the entire 10 to 40 could be capital gains.
But big difference.
Yes. So depending on if it's an internal or external buyer, sometimes, especially if it's an internal buyer, it's going to be taxed as compensation, ordinary income anyways. That actually might be a scenario where you wouldn't sell your ISO shares. You might sell your unexercised NSOs, especially if it's going to an internal buyer.
Right.
So that's, but these are kind of small technical details of, like, if you have decided to participate in the tender, then figuring out which shares to sell from a kind of tax benefit is start of the planning. Whereas you're still better off holding on to the ISOs and getting long-term capital gains at the liquid event, but you can cash out on the NSOs, but it'll be taxed at ordinary income. So that is one planning thing that comes up with tenders. And so I was trying to think of, are the tag along versus drag along, it sounds like it's related to that external versus internal buyer, but I couldn't quite place it in my mind.
Well, I've seen it in the context of external buyers where internal majority holders are looking to liquidate some of their positions.
Okay.
Selling to external buyers. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that might be a different, like if it's an internal buyer, then maybe it is trying to be an employee benefit, where they're just doing it to, well, no, they are doing it to give a liquidity option to employees who have been there for a long time and are waiting for this. But there are also dilution benefits of kind of reducing the outstanding shares, which can increase the stock price at the same market cap.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's not entirely for the benefit of the employees. There are internal reasons why the company would do this as well.
Right.
Okay. So we have tender offers. The next thing, like when we're discussing IPOs and that 6-month lockup, one of the things I should point out is that that's not a law or IRS requirement. It's actually a contractual agreement with the underwriter of the IPO. So a Goldman Sachs or Morgan Stanley, they'll come in and say, we're going to help sell your shares out in the market. This kind of goes back to like pre-internet days where you have to actually go out and sell to fund managers. Like, here, do you want to participate in this IPO? And so they have to actually go out and do this. And they're going to set an IPO price, but they don't want all the employees flooding the market with their shares that they've been waiting years to cash out. So the underwriter saying, in exchange for like setting this IPO price, we're going to have the employees wait 6 months before they can sell. So this is a contractual agreement with the underwriter. That's why direct listings who are not using an underwriter, it's not an IPO, they're just putting shares on the market and employees are selling, those tend not to have any kind of lockup requirements. But now, when you start to kind of factor in RSUs a little bit and NSOs, companies are, on a case-by-case basis, starting to provide some liquidity options earlier in the IPO. So I've seen a couple recent IPOs where they'll say, okay, employees can sell 15% of their vested options plus shares within the first week of trading after the IPO date. All other shares, they need to wait until 6 months. And so this is another factor that comes into that kind of liquidity and timing part of the conversation. So let's say we've gone through the life planning questions, and from that upside versus diversification benefit, we've said we're trying to cash out as quickly as possible in the most tax efficient manner. Okay. And I clarify that because you can just sell everything as soon as you can. That is always an option. That's the lowest investment risk. As soon as you can sell, you sell everything. It also probably has the highest tax bill. It means that you haven't exercised your ISOs. You haven't put any money at risk. You participate in the tender. It's all taxes, ordinary income. As soon as the lockup is in, or if there's a liquidity event in the first week, you're selling as much as you can, as soon as you can, and you pay the biggest tax bill. And this is okay. This is an acceptable, viable strategy, and I've helped clients do this, where they don't want to take on any of the extra investment risk. They're looking to diversify as soon as possible, and they acknowledge that they're paying the big tax bill. Because when we went through that life planning conversation about the kind of upside versus the security, they had no desire to try and get to a $10 million dollar net worth. There's no reason for them to hold on to the stock. And in fact, holding on to the stock and seeing the market go up and down and seeing this happen with other companies and other IPOs and just looking at any individual stock, the volatility, the ups and downs caused stress in their life. It made their life worse by holding on to this stock. And so there are legitimately good reasons to just sell everything as soon as you can. And that is okay. So that's one of the things I try to stress with people and clients, that as we go through the conversations, you can go back kind of all the beginning, wait and see, don't put any money at risk. Let's wait until if there's a liquidity event, you have the options, just wait and see. And you have the IPO, awesome. You're going to cash out. You'll pay a big tax bill. But you never had to put any money at risk and never had to watch the ups and downs. That is okay. Most people aren't that conservative. Most people, they like to get out of it. When we talked about those differences between long-term capital gains and ordinary income on $1 million, like they're thinking, okay, let's see if we can save that $150,000 in taxes. That, I think that's overwhelming my concern, because you can actually do the math of what would you, if you did the exercise and hold with the ISOs to get long-term capital gains, what does the stock price need to drop to where paying ordinary income results in less after-tax money? And sometimes it's on the scale of like 20 to 30%. So as long as the stock doesn't drop 20%, holding on to it, watching it drop 15%, and then you pay long-term capital gains, still nets you more money than selling at the higher price. And that's one of these kind of break-even analysis and conversations. Like, if you're willing to hold on to the company stock and take that risk, here's why doing a tax-efficient strategy can pay off. So I want to make sure, like, Do you have any other questions on the kind of cashing out versus upside part of the conversations I have with clients? Like, does that make sense to you? Anything you want to add to that before we move on?
So it seems like there's three options I see. One is the fully conservative option, like you said. The moment, just wait until you have the opportunity to cash out, you know, 6 months after the IPO, after the lockup period, you just immediately exercise, sell, and then, you know, wash your hands, you're done. Highest mm-hmm. tax burden, but safest in terms of you didn't have to put any of your money at risk, technically, because whatever you did to exercise, well, you immediately got that money back from selling the shares in the mm-hmm. open market. So that makes sense if you're, yeah, very conservative, or, you know, maybe it is a windfall that puts you at the 10 million after tax. And you're like, okay, I'm done.
Yeah.
You know, that's it. Let's call it a day.
I haven't had those cases, but that is a realistic possibility.
Right. So then, you know, the second option I kind of see is slightly less or a little more risky is you still wait that 6 months until after the lockup. And then you exercise then, and then you have this open option of being able to sell anytime you want, but hopefully just wait out a year, you know, if you can. It seems like that might be a little middle roadish.
I'm going to say no, but that's our next thing on timing.
Okay, and then let me lay out the third one just to get that in there, and that's just the super speculative option, or the more speculative option, where you're 6 months before the IPO. Again, you got to try to weasel that out through your own analysis, and then you try to exercise 6 months before, and you take on that risk for that 1 year period, and try to time your exit the moment the lockup ends.
That is closer. That's closer. Because another option is some combination of exercise and not selling, or not exercising.
Right. I mean, I'd say that what's left is just some combination of the three.
Okay. So this is like the timing of liquidity, and this is going to take more time up. But when it comes to that, just that concept of cashing out versus holding on to the risk, and like why it's a life planning conversation first, does that make sense to you?
Yeah. The question is, do you need to, want to, and are you able to take on this risk?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And so I make it very clear, any money that we're holding on to with the company stock, we cannot depend on for lifestyle. And so, because going back 2 years, if we had a plan of, okay, just keep maxing out your 401k and investing in a diversified portfolio and saving enough, you'll be financially independent in your 50s anyways. Like, we already can do that. And so if the liquidity event happens, you already have a plan of, you weren't depending on this money, so you can maintain a lifestyle, keep saving, maxing out your 401k, keep saving and investing for the future, and you'll be financially dependent in your 50s. That option is still on the table, that choice. I try to avoid using options when discussing options. That choice is still on the table. So that is the only scenario. You're saving enough, you have the cash reserve, you can depend on your salary, you like your job enough that you want to stick around for a couple decades. That's the scenario where it's okay to hold on to the company stock and take that big swing. Any money we leave in the stock, we do not want to depend on for lifestyle. But if you've taken care of everything else, it can be okay to hold on to the stock. And this becomes that conversation of, okay, do you want to try and see if we can get to a net worth of $10 million, or do you want to be financially independent in 7 to 10 years with $2 to $3 million? That's the kind of, it's an oversimplification, where instead of waiting until your 50s, they're financially independent sooner, which gives them just more life flexibility. But that's an example of that's why we're cashing out. We're not trying to get to $10 million. We just want to get to our $2 to $3 million so that I can go work at the next exciting startup and not have to worry about it. I can take a sabbatical. I can work part-time. Like there's other lifestyle choices that people feel comfortable making once they are financially independent. But that tends to be the reason I see people cash out sooner is they want to be financially independent sooner or have that extra investment or net worth that gives them more comfort to take on other risks or other ambitions. And so that's why it's like it's a life planning conversation about the diversification versus concentration, not a tax and investment conversation. Because the upside comes from concentration, could be in any single stock. It just happens that it's your company's stock, in partly because of the taxes. That if you're going to take on that risk, then we can be a little more efficient with ISO exercise strategies. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. You know, a few things came to my mind as you were saying that. You know, first, definitely a great point on understanding the lifestyle implications of this decision. You know, it certainly makes sense in my mind as well that takes the front row in terms of what to think about. You know, the other thing that was going through my mind is you mentioned there could be a case where an individual is pretty well set on their lifestyle, but they do plan on sticking around with the company for some time. You know, one thing that goes through my mind is, well, we don't want to concentrate too much into this one country company because, you know, after all, if your employment is hanging on by this company and, you know, most of your financial position in the actual stock is related to, you know, the performance of this company, well, then that might be just too much concentration when you add everything up together. So, you know, given that, you know, part of me was thinking, you know, the strategy we mentioned that in the last episode, the one you brought to light of just slowly year in, year out, if you plan on sticking with the company, just exercising enough to cover, to not go into AMT, yet still enough so that you're not building up too much on the golden handcuffs. Couldn't that strategy still persist into the stage where the company is post-IPO?
It can. But I haven't seen it play out that way.
It's interesting because I feel like, and then if you really want to leave the company, then yeah, by all means, just exercise everything and sell it before you leave.
Yes, that definitely can. And but I say I haven't seen it play out that way, mostly because it's never an all or nothing. Well, sometimes it's sell all, but it's never sell nothing. I don't think there's any, I haven't had any cases where they just didn't want to sell anything. They like always wanted to sell at least something. I want to get some benefit.
Right.
Leaving it all in the company stock was slightly too risky. And so I'll come to like a strategy that I've used in just a minute. But given the idea, like we're looking to sell something, that is a factor. And so that's why I say you could follow the same, keep exercising without going to AMT. Part of it is like the other thing, you'll actually run into expiration dates. Like if you're going to try and exercise without going to AMT, the options expire after 10 years. Like in our example, we said you have 100,000 options. You're only doing 5,000 per year. That's going to take 20 years. Like the options expire sooner. And so you almost have to exercise some that if you exercise and hold everything, the amount you're exercising will put you into AMT to make sure that you have exercised everything before the expiration date. Or you'll be doing some exercise and sell strategy Because if you exercise and sell immediately, even with ISOs, that's the disqualifying disposition we talked about last time, where it's treated as a non-qualified stock option, and there's no AMT concern. So with NSOs, because it's all ordinary income, there's no AMT concern. And so like you would exercise and sell some, pay the taxes on that, and with your proceeds, you could exercise and hold others maybe. So it's kind of, and I'll get to kind of like how that'll play out in a few minutes, but that tends to play out. It's rarely exercise and hold everything, because one, most people want to cash out anyways, and two, expiration dates. So if you're exercising holding, there is going to be some AMT concern. I mean, that's pretty consistent. Does that make sense?
Right. It does. So it seems like even if you want to extend the strategy from the last episode of just exercising enough each year to stay below AMT, you're still likely going to have one or a series of balloon years where AMT will be an issue because of that expiry date concern on the options.
Yep.
And then thinking one step forward, if that is a concern, then you may want to take an AMT hit at 1 year. Is that kind of how it works? And then you can amortize whatever can get you through the expiry date?
Okay. So short answer is maybe. But actually, yes. Yeah. So there's a couple things. So we're now saying we're trying to... We're going to exercise and sell some. We kind of want to cash out a little bit. We're not going to exercise and hold on to everything. But whatever we exercise, we probably do have some AMT concern. And so there are two factors that come into play. And you have to kind of understand AMT that you can use to your advantage. So when it came to that timing thing, you had mentioned like, waiting till the lockup, then exercising, that I didn't like at all. Like, you're almost better off exercising on the IPO date or like within that first week, plus or minus a week, so that 12 months from your exercise is 6 months after the lockup. There's no reason to like wait until the lockup ended to exercise and hold from that point forward. And so I have actually helped clients, we'll do an exercise and hold portion as soon as possible, knowing we have other vested options when the lockup ends, we're going to do an exercise and sell strategy with those. So anything that you're planning on doing exercise and hold, you probably want to do sooner than later. The slight caveats are you'll have that AMT bill. So if you do it too far in advance, then you might have a big AMT bill. You won't have the liquidity to do it. So let's say we think it's go into 2022. Company says they're going to IPO sometime in 2022. Let's say you exercise a big chunk of ISOs January 2022, but the IPO doesn't happen until October 2022. You have a 6 month lockup. You can't sell your shares until April 2023. So now you've satisfied the 12 month lockup or satisfied the 12 months of holding, but you will owe an AMT bill before April 15th. Like you have to actually pay the taxes. So you might owe an AMT bill based on your January 2021 exercise that you don't have the cash for. Now, using October, let's say it's November, pushes out into May. So like, because you don't know exactly when. So one of the dates that might pay attention to is when the company files the S1. This might be a pretty good sign that the IPO is going to happen in the next month or two. And that might be a rough good timing of when you could exercise ISOs that you're planning on holding a year, but make sure you're aware of like AMT. So it's like if they file an S1 in January, great. But if they file an S1 in October, if you do an exercise and hold strategy that October, your AMT bills due 6 months later. So your AMT bill is still due by April 15th of the following calendar year. So now you will start paying attention to timing of your ISO exercise and 12 months compared to the calendar year. And so if you're doing exercise and hold, planning on selling after a year, doing it earlier in the year in January, but after you know an S1 has been filed, that tends to make the most sense for publicly traded companies, where you can sell the shares the following January, or realistically, there's actually trading window concerns. So after one of the quarterly earnings reports that they open a trading window for employees, but you satisfied 12 months and it's before the following April. So you had liquidity to pay the AMT bill. Because even if you file an extension, the taxes are still due by April 15th. So you want to pay that because you don't want to start getting into late penalties and interest. That starts to add up in a way that the underpayment penalties don't. So kind of wait until you know when the S1 is. But it might be okay, depending on your situation, what your strategy is, of waiting until the following January to do a big exercise and hold. Or you'll do an exercise and hold of some, and knowing that 6 months later. So kind of if, let's say, S1 is filed in May. So you're going to do a exercise and hold strategy in May. You're going to hold those shares until May of the following year. But you have other ISOs that you're going to exercise and sell as soon as possible after the six-month lockup in November-ish. You're going to use the proceeds from that exercise and sell in November to pay the AMT bill from the exercise and hold back in May. Do you understand that timing?
Right. So part of that you can't control because it depends on when the window is. But if that does line up, so within the same year you can pull it off, then that's when you would do it. And is that window from January till April 15th?
No. It's a combination of when they file their S1, like, will there be any liquidity before 6 months? So again, if their particular IPO says you can exercise and sell, you can sell 15%, that might be enough to cover the AMT bill from anything that you exercise and hold.
Okay, so basically it's 6 months from before you need to pay the AMT bill would be the optimal time for the S1 to be filed.
Yes, you want to. But well, it depends.
Plus 2 months.
Either that or if there's everything is a 6 month lockup, cancel any
yeah,
6 months.
Let's keep that stick. To
then
that,
yeah, you probably want to exercise before October,
right?
So that you can be able to sell something by April 15th.
Got it.
Yeah.
Okay. That makes sense.
That's kind of like that's the big thing. Is like each individual company IPO is a little different. But this is the timing and liquidity that you need to plan out.
Right.
Okay.
You would think if they keep that in mind, or it happens to be whatever it happens to be.
It happens to be whatever it happens to be. There's so many other factors in trying to get an IPO. There's like the marketing of it. You don't want to IPO at the same time as other IPOs. You're trying to spread those out throughout the year. Like there's so much other planning that there's not going to be a good month for the company to IPO.
Right.
So, okay. So that's one of the big things to plan out in terms of timing and liquidity. Couple things that I mentioned here that tend to play out pretty well is the combination of exercising and holding some ISOs and exercising and selling other ISOs. So one, remember when we talked about the AMT, we have a regular calculation and an ISO calculation. And most of the time, our regular calculation is higher. And it's the ISO exercise that is, it will push us up into AMT. But that assumed that our regular calculation stayed the same, because all we had was our salaries, our employment income stayed the same. The disqualifying disposition, this exercising and selling ISOs immediately, having them treated as ISOs, increases your ordinary income. It increases your regular tax. And so it is actually possible where, since we are going to do the exercise and sell of some, exercises of and hold of others from a timing and liquidity perspective, we can actually calculate, okay, if I exercise and sell this much, I've added to my ordinary income, I've increased my regular tax calculation, and that creates more of a gap to exercise and hold other ISOs without going into AMT.
I like that.
So this is one of the strategies I help a lot of clients with, is I can actually calculate this with, and it's, a CPA will help get more precise, but requires kind of moving parts with stock prices, and CPAs don't want to give, they don't give investment advice, but it's usually in conjunction with a CPA we can pull off this kind of strategy where there's some break even, and I'll help, I'll actually do the math and kind of show, okay, if we exercise and sell this many ISOs, which both gives us price certainty, we don't have to hold on to it, and we have cashed out some, we're now increasing our regular calculation. So like, we were going to do this anyways, we've increased our regular calculation, now we have capacity to exercise and hold more ISOs without going to AMT. Okay? So that's kind of tactic number one. Okay? That tends to work out pretty well. The other one, you had mentioned, like, yeah, but if you're going to hold on to a lot of it, we're going to have one big balloon AMT year. So tactic number two is understanding AMT credits. So with our regular calculation and our AMT calculation, when AMT is more, the difference between the AMT calculation and the regular calculation, just that small marginal difference, is what our actual alternative minimum tax is. So when you file your tax return, you have the regular calculation, and they'll add on that additional amount of AMT. It's a completely separate calculation, but it's only that difference is considered the AMT, which is another reason why it looks confusing. That amount of AMT is creditable in the future. You get an AMT credit carry forward. So the next year that your regular calculation is greater than your AMT calculation, now again, that difference between the regular and the AMT, your AMT credit can offset that. You can actually reduce your regular tax down to your AMT using your AMT credit. And so from that perspective, AMT is not necessarily an evil to be avoided. It is sometimes more of a prepayment of taxes. Now, it can be a pretty big tax bill, and liquidity matters. So in our past conversations, we talked about the private companies, you don't have the money to pay the AMT bill. But now that we're at the IPO and liquidity is on the horizon, you may have the money to pay that AMT bill. And so even if we use that combination of raising, exercising and selling some, raising ordinary tax, giving us more capacity to exercise and hold others and pay AMT, even if we do go into AMT, we have that big lump sum because we do more exercise and hold. We have to sell some. We still have that AMT bill the first year, but the next year that our regular calculation is higher, usually it's the year we're selling our ISO shares at long-term capital gains and not exercising any new ISO shares, that tends to be the big year where regular calculation is a lot significantly greater than the ISO than the AMT calculation. So, sorry, excuse me. There's a leaf blower outside the window. I don't know if you can hear that. So the year that our regular calculation is significantly greater than our AMT, the AMT that we paid the prior year based on the ISO exercise could be creditable against that. Now, realistically, it's unusual that you would get all of the AMT credit back because your net worth has gone up, you have other income, you're probably still doing some ISO exercise based on vesting schedule. There are enough situations where you might get a $120,000 AMT credit. So in our example we talked about earlier, let's say that all the numbers are the same, but now we have some liquidity, we can pay it. So you paid $120,000, or it was, sorry, $70,000 of AMT. It was $50,000 exercise, $70,000 AMT. You have the liquidity to pay that. But instead of $70,000 offsetting your taxes, you might only get a credit against $40,000 because it's the difference between your regular calculation and AMT calculation, and both of those numbers have gone up because you have more money now. So it's not always a safe assumption that you will get an AMT credit, but knowing that exists, it is possible that if you have that big AMT year and you have the liquidity to afford that AMT bill, you could get a credit against your taxes the following year, the year after. So that's why I say in your example of that one big balloon AMT year, it really isn't that bad if you have the cash to pay it, if you have the liquidity from selling the stock. So it's okay. But again, you might have this weird situation where, okay, I sold $1 million in stock and I'm using this to exercise other ISOs. It's like, okay, I sold $1 million. I paid half in taxes. I'm paying AMT for my other exercise. And so like I sold $1 million, but I end up with a huge tax bill and a lot of stock that I'm not selling anyways. I have to wait until I can actually use any of that money. So it does feel kind of weird from that perspective. And so sometimes it's usually some other kind of middle ground of selling a little bit more, but that's kind of where it can play out.
So now, does the AMT credit expire after a certain number of years?
No, it does not expire. But pretty consistently when I do like future projections, things like dividends and interest on your newfound wealth, just the small increases in income, those tend to increase that regular calculation enough and also affect your AMT in a way that it's kind of like if you don't get to use it in the first, say, 2 to 5 years, because you can carry it for multiple years, then most likely you won't ever get to use it unless like your tax situation changed dramatically once you're no longer working and you can control like Social Security and retirement account withdrawals. But, right. But yeah, if you don't get to use it in the first 2 to 5 years, you may not end up using it up at all.
Yeah, that's interesting because, you know, if you assume the time value of money is zero and you assume you get your full AMT credit back eventually, that effectively means that you preserved your full ISO status. Lots of assumptions there.
Yeah, I'd say lots of assumptions, and none of those are safe assumptions.
Yeah, lots of unsafe assumptions.
But yeah, so that's why like AMT isn't necessarily the worst thing. It's usually a liquidity issue. Like you have to have the $100,000 to pay the AMT bill, and when the company's private, you don't have the stock to sell to pay that. But when the company is public, now you can start to have the liquidity. But yeah, it's like yes, assuming time value of money is zero, you have the liquidity, and you get to use the full AMT credit. Yes, it's just a prepayment.
Right. Well, see, the other thing that went through my mind is if you are planning to have this AMT balloon like you said, a good way to soften that is to take disqualifying dispositions. Mm-hmm. But also, you know, we mentioned before, if you have some of these NQSOs hanging around, NSOs hanging around, that might be a good year to exercise those. And that would also create a greater buffer to allow more hole in your AMT calculation.
So this is kind of like the fun with parallel tax calculations. Depending on how much you have in ISOs and how much you have in NSOs, you could actually do an ISO exercise and hold strategy if you're planning to do it anyways, and exercise NSOs and not really owe taxes on those.
Right, yeah.
Because the AMT was already so much higher, and it's a parallel calculation. Again, it wouldn't work that way because the NSO, the ordinary income would also be added to your AMT calculation.
But you're still
at a 28% marginal rate instead of a 37 or 39%. Yeah.
Right. So you get a marginal benefit.
Yes. So, but yeah, it gets complex. A financial advisor is working with a CPA in conjunction, but it's almost consistently, it's some combination of exercising and selling some ISOs or NSOs immediately, both getting price certainty, you remove the investment risk, and locked in that gain, and also increased your regular calculation to allow you to exercise and hold other ISOs and more ISOs without going to AMT. But yeah, so it's almost like some combination of the two strategies.
Right, right.
And then you start to add investing schedules. So like you probably got another grant before the IPO happened, and so you have more unvested, but these are probably NSOs. You probably have some RSUs now that as the company gets closer, they tend to switch from options to RSUs. And so RSUs, you don't have control of timing of the taxes. Just as soon as they vest, you owe the taxes. So in real life, all of these things get more complex and there's more planning involved, but these are the concepts kind of for ISOs specifically. That's all you have is a W-2 salary and ISOs. These are some of the planning topics that you can use to kind of balance that tax bill, liquidity, timing, investment risk, cashing out. This is why it takes me hours upon hours of work for each client. It's kind of like, this is why I make sure I don't take on too many clients.
Right. I can understand how there's so many moving pieces. It's like one of those nonlinear optimizations where you gotta.
Oh yeah. It's definitely like that. It's really like,
it's not linear at all.
Like I've seen there's an okay chart. Depending on your ordinary income, the amount of ISOs you can exercise without going into AMT starts at like 30. You make more, it goes down to 10. You make more, and it goes back up to 30. It was like a weird like V-shaped difference between ordinary income and AMT. I think it was like around where the marginal tax rate starts to change. It was... definitely a non-linear optimization. There was one other thing I was thinking about when it came to ISOs and AMT, but I think I just lost it. But I think that was probably enough for today.
Well, we covered a lot of ground, Aaron, so I always learn a ton when we talk about this stuff. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, and this one, like I had some notes to kind of jot down in preparation for our past three episodes, but a lot of this I've been doing these client cases for enough years that like some of the numbers I was giving you are pretty close. Like, unfortunately, the numbers that I get are never round numbers. Instead of a $40 tender, it was a $42 tender. Instead of the fair market value at the time being $20, it's like $21.80. It's like, so like I have these kind of rough numbers in my mind, but I need to use Excel and financial planning softwares to track these differences.
Yeah, I can imagine it's definitely not a back of the napkin calculation.
No, it is not. It is definitely not. Even Excel sometimes is not good enough to get this correct.
Right.
So, but it's a lot of fun. I really enjoy helping clients get through these.
Good stuff, Aaron.
So, I'd love to hear, you know what? I'd love to hear if anyone has ISOs and they have another question that I didn't get to in the last three episodes. Because I was trying to be as complete as I could, but I'm sure there's still something I missed. So if you have ISOs in a private company, I would love to hear from you.
Great, Aaron. And, you know, thanks for the conversation. And thanks, everybody, for listening.
Bye.
Bye.
We appreciate you joining us today for this episode of the Mind Money Spectrum podcast. Be sure to visit mindmoneyspectrum.com to access the entire library of episodes. Remember, it's not black and white, but the wide spectrum of gray area where you get to pursue the freedoms you want in life. Opinions voiced in this material are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. All performance referenced is historical as no guarantee of future results. All indices are unmanaged and may not be invested in directly. Have a nice day.